Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Don't go away. It's time to play You Solve the Budget. That was the New York Times deficit reduction puzzle in the Week in Review section on Sunday. And on their website, that was the headline, You Solve the Budget, You Fix the Budget. We have the chief puzzle master, Times economics columnist David Leonhardt, who has written the accompanying articles. And we invite you all to go to our webpage where we have a link right to the puzzle. David's going to help lead us through this and see if we have the stomach to make the cuts to Social Security or Medicare or the military or other things that might be necessary, and to raise your own taxes as might be necessary to avoid an American fiscal catastrophe in the coming years. Go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show if you want to play along. And David Leonhardt, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you. And I love Chief Puzzle Master. I think I'm going to start calling myself that.
Yeah, if you and Will Shortz run into each other in the hall, though, you'll have to duke it out.
I will yield to Will Shortz.
This has been a big hit around here, by the way, because it's so clearly designed and so tempting. It's a great teaching tool on some of the real numbers involved, at the same time as an irresistible game to kind of torture ourselves with these unthinkable choices. How many New York Times readers have actually done this? Are you measuring?
Someone is. I actually don't know the latest number. The number I do know, although it's high, the number I do know is that as of 2 days ago, just above 10,000 people had tweeted their own deficit solution. Mm-hmm. So obviously that's just a fraction of people who've done it, but I got an email from someone saying we'd crossed the 10,000 mark on Twitter.
Great. Well, before we go through some of the choices, remind us of the basics here. The object of the game is to cut $1.3 trillion from the federal budget for the year 2030. What does that mean in layman's terms?
Well, the way I like to describe this is we really have two deficits. We've got a medium-term deficit, which is sort of a moderate problem, and we've got a long-term deficit that is a very big problem. And what we essentially need to do is, not immediately, because the economy is still so weak, if we start cutting the deficit now by raising taxes or cutting spending, it would be quite damaging. But over the next 5 years, we need to start cutting the deficit. And we basically need to have a series of ascending cuts. So we implement a cut, say, in 2015, or a bunch of cuts in 2015, and then we leave those in place in 2016, but we add some new cuts. And by the time we get to 2030, we basically need cuts that equal almost $1.4 trillion in today's dollars by 2030. Many of those cuts are going to have to be implemented far before 2030 to keep the interest payments on the debt from exploding. But by the time we get to 2030, we need to be at $1.4 trillion, mostly to help pay the bill for Medicare and, to a lesser extent, Social Security, because baby boomers have not paid nearly as much in taxes as they will receive in benefits. And to ask those of us who will still be working then to cover all of those benefits would require crushing taxes. So that's where we are.
Mm-hmm. And looking at your options, you have two overarching categories, spending cuts and tax hikes, as you just laid out. And it's very clear on the puzzle. And there is one clear biggest ticket spending cut item that is more than a half trillion dollars, the only one that even approaches this figure. Nothing else comes close. And that is capping Medicare spending growth at the rate of growth. And this is the rate of growth of the overall economy, or GDP, plus 1%. Is almost everyone including that option in their answer?
No. Many, many people are not. It's interesting. That helps remind you of just how controversial and in many cases unpopular changing Medicare and changing spending growth is. If you think back to last year's healthcare debate, one of the most popular talking points that people like to have was, this plan should do more to hold down costs. In fact, I wrote many columns arguing the plan should do more to hold down cost. But that sounds like it's easy. But when you actually get down to changing healthcare policies, people stop thinking about this in terms of restraining costs and maybe allowing them to earn higher pay. And they instead think about their medical care potentially being changed, and they don't like that. And so we just gave one example of the kind of thing you would need to do to restrain Medicare growth. You would probably need to crack down on high-spending hospitals and doctors. You'd need to look and find doctors that are spending large amounts of money on care and don't have sicker patients and aren't getting better results, and so thus their costs are not easily explainable. In our own hometown, NYU is a great example of this. Now, if you go to NYU, they will not tell you that they are wasteful. They will instead give you a long list of reasons, and I would argue in many cases excuses, about why they have high costs even though they don't have sicker patients or better results. The other kinds of things you'd need to do are tax healthcare benefits. You and I have talked about that before. A lot of people don't like that idea. You would need to say, you know what, if you want to get this more expensive brand name drug, you can get it, but we're only going to reimburse you for the price of the less expensive drug because scientific trials have shown that less expensive drug to be just as effective. These are among the reasons we have the most expensive healthcare system in the world. It is the biggest reason we are facing this soaring long-term deficit. But solving it isn't easy because there are trade-offs. Every time you hold down cost growth, you have the potential of hurting the quality of medical care.
That was pretty specific what you said about NYU, and I realize this is a tangent to the budget, and I'm sure they would disagree with it in strong terms. But
yes.
how do you come to the conclusion, from your point of view, that NYU Medical Center wastes money in ways that maybe Beth Israel or New York Presbyterian or whatever might not?
And I don't want to suggest it's the only one. We've actually written about this, so if people are interested in seeing some of NYU's defense, they can look at some of the articles we've written about hospitals in New York. That data comes from data from the Dartmouth Atlas, in which they look at spending of different hospitals. And I come to the conclusion because it's undeniable that NYU has much higher costs, and they have yet to produce evidence to me that's at all persuasive, or to many healthcare experts, which is more interesting than my thoughts, that show that they have sicker patients or get better results. They tend to say, and I shouldn't pick just on them, it's also UCLA, and UCLA offers the same sort of defense. They tend to say that they're a teaching hospital, and teaching hospitals inevitably have higher costs. And I actually don't doubt that. All I know is that we have huge, huge healthcare costs in this country. We spend far more than any other country does. We also have highly variable healthcare costs. So there are some hospitals that really do an excellent job of holding down costs, and there are others that don't. But when you go and you ask the hospitals that have really high costs why they do, they always end up having reasons. Maybe NYU, in fact, is one of the few that actually has justifiable reasons. But on the whole, we are clearly wasting a lot of money. And yet, when you actually go to find that waste, and I'm sorry to take us so far from the deficit, the inevitable answer is, oh, well, other people may be wasting money, but we're not.
So if government policy looked or was articulated in certain ways, then the hospitals and doctors that may be wasteful would have certain incentives that they don't have now to cut it down, is I think where this relates back to the deficit.
Yes, and to come back to your point about the puzzle, it is by far the biggest money saver on there because Medicare growth is the biggest cause of the deficit. And there are many people, I'm obviously among them, who find it to be among the most important ways to reduce the deficit. But it comes with downsides, and it's interesting to note that a lot of our readers don't gravitate to that. They would rather put together more smaller items than that big item.
So, listeners, we want your phone calls. You can also go to our website, WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehr Show, and we have a link there right into David Leonhardt's budget puzzle, the New York Times Week in Review budget puzzle. You fix the budget. You can see the Medicare savings choice and all the others. Go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehr Show. If you haven't done this yet, through the Times own website directly. And we want to open up the phones as well for anybody who has done this during the week. Are you one of the thousands of people who took a pencil or went online and did it and actually got your head around this and tried to balance the budget, tried to close the federal debt and federal deficit over the long term? 212-433-WNYC. What did you choose? What did you find the hardest part? Some people, of course, are quibbling with the design of this and the way the choices were presented, and you can do that too. But we want to know what your experience was actually trying to fix the budget in this week in review puzzle. 212-433-WNYC. What did you learn about the budget process while doing this? And I'm sure many of you came up against many tensions, worthy things or painful things that pull against each other that you had to work hard to choose between. 212-433-WNYC if you want to share your experiences. But I want to stay on that Medicare choice for just a minute because,
great,
again, it's so big. Out of the goal, yep, of cutting $1.4 trillion from the deficit by 2030, this would be $560 billion of that, the only thing in that range at all. And it sounds so reasonable when it's stated the way the choice is stated, that Medicare can grow at the rate of growth of the overall economy plus 1%. That doesn't sound so painful. Why would it be painful?
Because we basically have a healthcare system that resembles an all-you-can-eat buffet. If a doctor or a hospital says you should get this procedure or this test, Medicare will almost always pay for it, and your private insurance will almost always pay for it. And all the incentives are to do more. If doctors are worried about being sued, they have an incentive to do more. If doctors and hospitals get a percentage of the revenue from a test or a drug or a procedure, they have an incentive to do more. We patients tend to think much more about the risks of inaction than the risk of action. So for someone who's thinking about whether to have a stent inserted, they worry, if I don't have this inserted, I'll have a heart attack. They don't tend to worry about the side effects or the risks, sometimes even including the risk of death, of a surgery or a procedure. And so we all tend to go toward more, more, more. I think part of it is natural human instinct. I think part of it is the incentives in our system. And I think part of it is American culture. And as a result, we have this massively expensive healthcare system. And restricting the growth even to GDP plus one percentage point would shave a huge amount of money off of the amount that we spend on MRIs and brand name drugs and CT scans and heart procedures and back surgeries and you name it.
How much do the death panels save? No, I'm just kidding.
Well, that's a great example, right? So Atul Gawande, the New Yorker's wonderful medical writer, had a lovely piece this year about hospice care. And that's exactly what the death panel stuff was about. It was about the idea of giving people counseling that would try to make them more aware of the options for hospice care. Like many people, I've had some firsthand experience with seeing people go through hospice care. I've had really excellent experiences with hospice care. The Atul Gawande article made that same point. And the idea of giving people advice that they may want to consider hospice care seems like the kind of thing that has huge benefits all around. It can save a lot of money. And for many people, it is a much more pleasant way to spend their final months. Yet, when it was put into healthcare reform, it was turned into this notion that, in fact, we're going to have people who tell you you must die. And that is just one good example of how saving money in healthcare can become politically really charged.
David Leonhardt, New York Times economics columnist, who wrote the articles accompanying the budget puzzle, You Fix the Budget. Brian from Brooklyn writes on our website, I solved the budget crisis mostly on the revenue side. I removed the Bush tax cuts for the rich, created a millionaire's tax, carbon tax, and bank tax, returned the estate tax and investment rates to Clinton levels, and raised the payroll tax cap. I capped Medicare growth, however. This will require medical care regulation through reform, not through taxation. Overutilization is the major problem here, writes this listener. That is, doctors make more money when they provide more medical care, a cost incentive that must be outlawed. He says, I also eliminated loopholes but kept taxes slightly higher and reduced the mortgage income tax deduction. Before we go to the phones and hear from other people who played the budget game and some of the tensions they came up against and difficult choices they made, I think we see in this puzzle, and I think a lot of people who never thought about it in these terms probably learned just by attempting to do this puzzle, how small some of the items are that politicians like to talk about cutting the most. Half off foreign aid would only save $15 billion. Half off the farm subsidies, $15 billion. All earmarks total $30 billion. Laying off 10% of the federal workforce saves just $15 billion. And we say just $15 billion. Well, I mean, that's a lot of money, and they certainly add up if you do all of them. But I think the takeaway here, and one of the things that I think you were trying to get at, seems to be that you have to confront Medicare, you have to confront the military, you have to confront Social Security, and you have to ask hard questions about taxes. You can't do it on the backs of these things that politicians find easy to talk about.
That's exactly right. And those $15 billions you just named, that's each one of those is about 1% of the 2030 gap that we need to close. So, you know, even you pick six of them and you've got 94% still to go. My big four is the exact same as yours: Medicare, Social Security, the military, and taxes. I don't think you can talk seriously about reducing the deficit unless you're willing to talk about making changes to one of those four, probably two of those four, maybe all three or four. And the argument for higher taxes, just in brief, is that as societies become richer, they tend to want a government that is a larger share of GDP. You just look at the United States over the last century. Our government's grown from something like 2% of GDP to, when a recession isn't going on, 18%. That's because as you get richer, you want a strong military, you want schools, you want health care, you want services the government tends to provide. And right now in this country, we are fulfilling that pattern in that we want a bigger and bigger government, but we're not willing to pay for the taxes for it. And that at some point is just going to have to stop. I hope one of the lessons of this puzzle is that this is a solvable problem, but it's a problem that we need to solve while making some compromises and some trade-offs.
When we continue with David Leonhardt, we'll drill down a little bit more on some of those tax hike choices that the puzzle presents. And we will take your calls on how you struggled and solved America's budget problem with this New York Times Week in Review, You Fix the Budget Puzzle. 212-433-WNYC, if you want to tell your story of using the puzzle. Actually, all our lines are full at the moment, but as people finish up, you can get in, and we'll talk more about taxes. And if you want to see the puzzle for the first time and haven't yet, we have a link on our show page, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with David Leonhardt, New York Times economics columnist, as we try to fix the budget. You fix the budget puzzle from the New York Times Week in Review section. Again, you can get to the link on either of our pages, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show, or right through our politics website, itsafreecountry.org. And some of our It's a Free Country bloggers wrote about trying to do the puzzle. Let's see. Reshma Shojani raises Peter Orszag's recommendation, the former CBO director, Congressional Budget Office director, of extending the Bush tax cuts for 2 years and then completely eliminating them. Orszag says doing so would reduce the deficit by $200 billion to $350 billion per year from 2015 to 2020. Conservative blogger Carol Markowitz on our site used the budget balancing game. She said, cut foreign aid in half, cut salaries for our returning troops, and raise the retirement age to 70 years old. Matt on Long Island, you're on WNYC. Hi, Matt.
Hey, Brian, how you doing?
Good. So how was your experience with the puzzle?
I should state at the top, I'm a very liberal person, and I accomplished balancing the budget through 59% spending cuts and 41% revenue increases. When the healthcare bill came out last year, I was just really disappointed by the fact that they sort of gave up in a forfeit the idea of trying to provide universal coverage for people. And I guess studying our spending against the world, the thing that always struck me was our education spending was lower, but our military spending was always much higher. So I guess I always thought in the back of my head that the way you could achieve universal healthcare coverage was through military cuts. And I was really struck on the puzzle by how little savings there really is to gain by cutting the R&D budget. I mean, we save money by bringing our troops home from the Iraq War, but that's not going to go on forever anyway. So, like, just the larger question of how much we're spending on our military, like, forever, there's really not that much. There's not that much to be gained, is there?
David?
This is one of these cases in which we had to make some choices. And so our military cuts come into two categories. The first, as Matt mentioned, is bringing troops home from Iraq and Afghanistan more quickly, which actually saves a lot of money. And the second is a package of cuts that was recommended by something called the Sustainable Defense Task Force, which was a group that Barney Frank, the Massachusetts congressman, appointed. And these were a whole group of defense experts, both from the right and the left, and they recommended a big package of cuts that would probably cut down the United States military by something like 1/6, which is a lot. We included all of those in our game. That's what you see. You see those organized in different ways. Now, would it be possible to cut the military even more deeply than that? I think it would be. It might have really bad consequences. It might not. And in every one of these options, we had to make a decision. We obviously didn't want to give people 200 options. But we kind of erred on the side of we wanted to go to what was politically imaginable in the next few years and then go further than that. And it seems to me that $100 billion a year in defense cuts does that. On the other hand, certainly, if someone became king, they could cut more than $100 billion a year from the military because it's $600 billion a year. And so I don't know what the impact would be, but just from an arithmetic sense, yes, you could cut more from the military.
And your biggest military ticket item was save $170 billion by speeding up withdrawal of troops from Iraq and Afghanistan to a total of just 30,000 remaining by 2013. That was the biggest single military savings on the way toward trying to save $1.4 trillion total to balance the budget. Let's try Marge in South Orange. Marge, you did the puzzle?
I did, but my question is about the Medicare costs, and I don't ever hear anybody talking anything about the administrative costs, wasted administrative costs from the hospitals as well as the pharmaceutical companies. Well, corporate medicine is costing a lot more than it ever used to cost, and what happens to that?
David, how do you monetize that or take that into account?
That's a great question. One of the things we really wanted to avoid here was giving people options that felt painless, right? Like eliminate waste from the military or eliminate waste from healthcare, because our view is that if it's painless, we would have done it already. But that is exactly the kind of thing that would be covered by the Medicare option. So if you limit healthcare growth to GDP plus 1%, to some extent you're saying to hospitals, you figure out where to find that savings. And if they can find it by eliminating administrative waste, which a lot of experts think they could find some of it by doing so, then they would have to make fewer painful decisions, painful to them, about when to cut back on some of the utilization.
Mike in Astoria, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mike. On the military, right?
Yeah, but I'm on the website, and I just wanted to know something that I thought was kind of interesting, though. When I looked at the Bush tax cuts, I noticed that it seems that you would generate more revenue if you allowed the Bush tax cuts to expire for those below $250,000 versus those above $250,000, or if you include all of them. I mean, the revenue almost doubles when you add in everybody else's tax cuts. And I'm wondering, is the key to raising revenue to hit everybody almost equally in terms of raising taxes? Or is, because it seems like, you know, everyone's trying to sell like a free lunch to everybody else by saying, oh, you know, we just raise those taxes for everybody above 250 and, you know, everything's fine. But according to these numbers, we get a lot more bang for our buck by including everybody in the raising of the taxes. And the other question is, how do you deal with the jobs that get generated from generally a lot of this government spending, whether it's indirect or direct? Because, you know, you get tax revenue back from that. So if you're spending money on defense spending, obviously you have the corporate tax that these companies are paying, you have income tax that the workers are paying. So our technological development as a nation without the defense spending that goes on.
Go ahead, David.
I'll take the tax part of that in detail, which is You're right. The Bush tax cuts are much more expensive for the below $250,000 a year in income than above, and that's because the below is 98% of the population. So even though the average person in the bottom 98% of the population got a much smaller tax increase than the affluent, there are so many more people below that cutoff than above it that it is more expensive. The tax problem we have is really twofold, and these are a little bit opposing ideas. The first is that I think the solution to the deficit almost certainly needs to involve higher taxes on the affluent. Over the last 30 years, people in the top, however you define it, 3%, 2%, 1%, have gotten by far the biggest pre-tax pay increases, and they've also had their tax rates fall much more than everyone below that threshold. And so they've gotten massively larger increases in post-tax income than the middle class, the upper middle class, or the poor. And so to me, the argument for taxing them more than we do now, given that we have a deficit, not for punitive reasons, but because we have to find revenue somewhere, is extremely strong. Some people, Felix Salmon, who's a writer for Reuters and my nominee for the best named journalist in the world, had an argument. He thought that we didn't let you tax the rich enough. And I responded in a blog post saying, you know, you can actually, just by taxing the rich, get close to solving half the deficit problem. But again, as with the military, he's right. We could have let you turn the dials even more. Having said that the taxes on the wealthy probably need to and should rise, that by itself won't get us the whole solution, because the rise in Medicare costs and, again, to a lesser extent, Social Security are so big that we are either going to also need to cut those programs or we're going to need to raise taxes on everyone to pay for them.
And Felix was just here. Last week on the show. And yes, Felix Salmon is a great name. David the Leonhardted is not so bad either.
Thank you.
David Leonhard, New York Times economics columnist, with us as we try to fix the budget from the You Fix the Budget New York Times Week in Review puzzle, 212-433-WNYC. Now, on the taxes question, your biggest choices are to save $250 billion by letting the Bush tax cuts expire on the rich, a different $315 billion tax cut change that I don't understand, or impose a national sales tax and raise $280 billion. Would that be a national sales tax on top of current income tax rates?
Yes, it would. And let's come back to that 315, because if you don't understand it, that means we should do a better job in explaining it. But the national sales tax would indeed be on top of current income taxes. You'd think of it like a sales tax, but it would be a national one. Every other industrialized country in the world, with one exception besides the United States, has such a national sales tax. The exception is Saudi Arabia, and they obviously have a revenue source that we don't. The argument for doing that is that not only does it raise revenue, but it actually encourages the kind of behavior we want. We've been spending too much and not saving enough. And so that taxing consumption as opposed to taxing income gives people more of an incentive to save. But it has downsides. So, you know, a lot of people worry it's regressive, that no matter how many rebates you build in, it's probably going to be regressive.
And your biggest revenue-raising option was that $315 billion, which you described as reduce individual and corporate tax breaks while also cutting income and corporate tax rates. Net effect is to raise taxes, corporate rates are tax. That's it. I'm going to stop there. So explain it.
Sure. And this comes really directly from the plan that Erskine Bowles, the former Clinton chief of staff, and Alan Simpson, the former Republican Senate leader, put out. And with so many of these things, you can turn the dials in lots of different ways. But the easiest way to think about this is think about your mortgage interest deduction, if you get one, or think about any deduction you get. Imagine that you lose that, but then the rate on your income, the tax rate on your income, comes down. But it doesn't come down by enough to completely make up for the loss of the deductions. The advantage of a tax code like this from the standpoint of economic growth is that it should lift growth because people will spend less time trying to figure out how to qualify for this tax break or that tax break, and they'll just do what they want to do, what they think is the most efficient thing to do, which all else equal tends to lead people to behave more efficiently and to produce more growth. You can make that kind of tax reform in which you get rid of loopholes and you bring down rates. You can do that in a way that is revenue neutral, which is what happened in 1986 tax reform. so that you basically give back all the money you take away in deductions with lower tax rates, or you can do it in a way that raises tax revenue. There is an argument for this kind of tax reform on the grounds of economic growth, regardless of whether it raises money or is revenue neutral. Because of the size of the deficit we're facing, we almost certainly would want to do one of these that raises revenue, which is to say when you lose your mortgage interest deduction, you don't get all of it back through lower tax rates, but you get some significant portion of it back through lower tax rates.
Now, Henry from Katona, writing on our website, challenges this entire enterprise. He writes, balancing the budget is for chumps. Didn't Dick Cheney tell Paul O'Neill that deficits don't matter? It would appear that he was correct. Clinton and the Dems, you might include the GOP Congresses from 1995 to 2000, got zero credit for erasing the last deficit. Wasn't there a poll this year where a plurality said that they trust Republicans to deal with the deficit? If that poll was correct, the public has a very short memory. But his main point is balancing the budget is for chumps, as he puts it. Didn't Dick Cheney tell Paul O'Neill that deficits don't matter?
Dick Cheney did, and politically, he may or may not be right, but economically, deciding that deficits don't matter is a recipe for national decline. When Eisenhower talked about national security, he didn't simply mean the military with it. He also meant economic security. He was very explicit about this. And if we do not deal with our deficits, if we become an insolvent country, we're going to have a lot of problems. And so I don't think there's any doubt that deficits don't matter. You can argue very strongly that we should not be balancing our budget right now or anytime soon because of this recession we're in. But I just don't see an argument, aside from politics, that says we can ignore our deficit and be okay.
And last thing before you go, because we played the deficit puzzle, and we've spent most of the time, as I guess a lot of the users on your site did, trying to balance various tax increases with various spending cuts. But you wrote a front page article on Wednesday about the role of economic growth in all of
this,
right? We usually hear about spending cuts versus tax hikes as a zero-sum game. But as you point out, economic growth changes the whole equation. How so?
That's right. If we grow more quickly, people are making more money and we get more tax revenue in, and our future deficit won't be as big as we now think. Of course, if we grow more slowly, it'll be bigger than we now think. So I think we have to plan for the idea that it'll be roughly what we are expecting on economic growth and not sort of wish ourselves into thinking we're going to get faster growth. But at the same time, I think we should do everything we possibly can to lift growth. And to me, that doesn't just mean more tax cuts. I mean, we had huge tax cuts in 2001, and yet the last decade had the slowest economic growth of any decade since World War II. It probably means something like the tax reform I just described with lower rates but fewer deductions. I think it certainly means more investment in education and in scientific research and probably in infrastructure, although I don't think that's quite as important as education and scientific research because if you look over history, if you look at the Internet was built by the Defense Department. The NIH has funded the great modern biotechnology industry. Government can play a huge role in lifting growth by funding basic science and by producing an educated population. And then the private market, places like Google and Amgen and all the private companies that have built off of those government investments, can build great products that cause economic growth from that and then in turn bring down our deficit. And so I agree with you completely. It's not simply about spending cuts. It's about cutting spending in ways that don't raise economic growth, like I would argue farm subsidies, and raising taxes in ways that won't really damage economic growth. And then what we hope is that this ends up being a little bit easier than we now think it's going to be, or maybe even if we grow a lot more quickly, a lot easier than we hope. I just think we probably shouldn't plan for the weather to be sunny all the time 30 years from now.
But to leave us with a little bit of hope, and to Henry from Katona's point about the 1990s, you wrote in that article that the deficit of today is smaller than in the years 1990 to 94, which then got balanced in just a few years of economic growth during the Clinton administration. Could that be true? Is today's deficit actually smaller than the years 1994? I don't remember hearing the word trillion before when it came to the annual deficit.
No. What I wrote was that the 2015 deficit is now projected to be smaller than the deficits from 90 to 94, and that's because we're going to get some growth between now and then.
Uh-huh.
you know, you could kind of construct an argument for how economic growth would eliminate the short-term deficit if it's really much faster than we expect and we got to rerun the 90s all over again. Of course, that's probably not the most likely scenario. But the long-term deficit almost surely cannot be paid off with growth alone. And so I think that argues for a combination of good investments, spending cuts, tax increases, not immediately. But also, I agree with you. I mean, I don't think this needs to be a depressing exercise. We wanted to put down specifics in part because the debate in some ways is silly, right? People say if only we did this easy thing, we could balance the budget. When you look at this, you see that you have to make hard choices. But you also see that this is not impossible. This is something we can do. It's certainly within the realm of difficult tasks that this country has accomplished before. And I think the most likely scenario is that eventually we'll get it right.
Well, thanks for presenting such an interesting learning tool that's also so fun to play with, even if sometimes agonizing. David Leonhard, New York Times economics columnist. His Week in Review cover feature this week was Budget Puzzle, You Fix the Budget. You can still link to it through our site, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show if you want to get there that way. And David, thanks so much for spending so much time with us to walk everybody through this.
Well, thanks for pointing listeners to it, and thanks to all the listeners for the good comments and ideas.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in a minute, we will look at Facebook's new email launch and what's different about it from other kinds of email, but also at people who keep their old email addresses. Why are you still you at AOL.com or CompuServe.com? Stay with us.